Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, this looks to be, you know what, I was going to say last Toy Department of 2020, but it's not true. The Thursday one, right, on
yeah.
New Year's Eve?
Well, it's the last generalist Toy Department of 2020, and thank goodness, not because of us, but because of this year. Let it be done. Let it be over.
Good riddance. Good riddance indeed. And we have got a lot of movies to cover. I mean, I guess it's really four movies. We watched them all on TV, you know, which I think is a sign of how much the lines between those two things are blurring in this year, but probably going forward as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, for a while, right?
At least a while. Yeah. Like, I don't think the theater's going to go away. People like leaving their house and communal experiences.
I mean, look, I love the theater. So for me, I've always planned to go back when we're safe, and I still do. I'm not going to change that at all.
Yeah, you know, I'm on record, and you probably know this, that right, that I do enjoy going to the movies, but my goal is to go with as few people as possible. I really
always,
you know, I like midday.
Like as few strangers.
Things. Yeah, I like, you know, I like to go to the movies at off times when hardly anyone's there. Like, if there's three people in the theater and I don't feel bad about pulling out my cell phone, like, that's kind of like an ideal sort of situation for me.
Why do you want to pull out your cell phone, though?
I don't necessarily want to pull out my cell phone. I'm just saying okay. I need to pull out my cell phone. Uh-huh. Although, typically, right, we're, you know, a lot of times when I go to the movies, it's for this pod, and I like to take notes, which I can then do.
Right. That makes sense.
Cell phone.
I'm with you on the going with as few people as possible, but that actually for me is more about other people not pulling out their cell phones.
There's also that, right? Because
yeah.
I don't want to be a jerk, and people. For me, it's people talking more than
right. That's what
lights,
I meant. I only said the cell phone thing because you said the cell phone thing. Yeah, it's about the noise. The noise and the popcorn crunching and the wrapper crinkling. Like, I want to immerse myself in front of the big screen. That's why I'm there.
Yes, I like a big screen. I don't. There's certain kinds of movies that I don't mind seeing with a lot of people. You know what I mean? Like a Star Wars. For me, the classic was when Snakes on a Plane came out. I saw that in like a really crowded theater on opening night. And
totally agree.
People got into it and got super ridiculous
that's
about it. And it made
the perfect
it way
movie. The perfect example of a movie you want to watch with people because it's both. It's both comedy and big action. Like,
okay.
Those are the movies you want to see with a lot of people, right? Either something where you want to be laughing with a group of people all the time or, like, gasping with a group of people all the time. You don't want to see, like, a romantic movie or, like, a period drama, maybe at all, but certainly in a theater full of people.
Right. You know, we like a lot of talky movies and thrillers and
yeah.
things like that are, yeah, the kind of movies that you don't really want to see. With
right.
people so much.
No,
so.
Because first of all, people are stupid in general. So like sometimes
yes.
you get someone who thinks they're funny saying something in a moment that like takes the entire theater out of the experience, you know? And also just the noise. The noise of people is frustrating. So I'm with you on generally trying to minimize how many people are in the theater, not going. I had a no Friday movies for policy for a long time.
Yeah.
Just because Friday night is always popping at the theater. But yeah, I don't know that we've ever talked about that before, but I do agree.
Let's start this week with a movie that a lot of people wanted to see. And then I'm not sure that I want to see with people or without people, in the future. And that's Wonder Woman 1984.
Yeah. You know, I was braced for a fight before we ever watched it. Cause I know going into a superhero movie, generally speaking, like I am much more likely to enjoy it than you are, and I kind of think you prejudge superhero movies a lot of the time and never give them a chance. And then, you know, you watch a movie like this and I know I don't have to worry about fighting with you because there's no way you thought it was good because it was not.
Because it wasn't good. It's actually, it's weird. Like, the reverse is starting to happen. Like, that I'm generally now so choosy about the superhero movies that I see that the ones that I see tend to be good or interest me.
Or you have expectations for them, which I think we both did for this, right? Because you actually kind
I like
of
the first one.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I was going to say. And this, like, the only thing that was good about the first one that was still in this one is Gal Gadot is just unbelievably beautiful. Like, my wife said at least 5 times during this movie, oh my God, she's so hot.
Yeah, and it's like, it's not just that she's hot. I mean, obviously she's hot.
No, right, but she's me, like,
but it's like, she's Amazonian.
That's right.
Almost, right? Like, it's like, she's that kind of hot where you're like, I'm not even sure that this person is the same species
exactly.
as most of the other people walking around. And that, I feel like, is ideally suited for this kind of role, right? So,
this role, specifically this role.
Yeah.
And, like, the casting is phenomenal here with respect to Gal Gadot. Like, they found the woman on Earth who is just most incredibly believable as a Amazonian superhero. Like, there's no reason not to think Gal Gadot can actually do that stuff in real life. Like, as far as I'm concerned, there might not be special effects in this movie. Because it's just totally believable that woman has special powers when you look at her, which is great. And the only great thing about this movie, literally nothing else about this film certainly is great. I don't even know if it's good. This is a movie that has no real story. I mean, I don't want to diss the actors because I think everybody's perfectly fine at worst.
Right.
Some of them are good. But the story, the writing, the length, like, guys, what happened?
I feel like what happened was they realized they had a talkie superhero movie and were like, oh, well, we need to tack on some, you know, big set pieces here, you know, so you get this sort of more superhero-y last 45 minutes that's really soulless and feels a little almost tacked on to the kind of, you know, talky examination of, like, loss that sort of happens before it, you know what I mean, or loss or wanting to belong, you know?
Yeah, but the way you say that it sort of is a point I wanted to make, right? Yeah, you could say it's like an examination of loss, I guess, but really what it is like a bunch of trite reasons why someone might be sad all stuffed into one movie without any through line or sense to it. Right.
Yeah.
Cause like
yep.
Pedro Pascal, it wants to be this great man with a bunch of money and Kristen Wiig just wants people to like her. And Wonder Woman is dealing with this profound loss or so we're led to believe. And yet, none of the, like, the plot does not set up or pay off any of those in a meaningful way. They're just like, what can this person be sad about? I guess he wants to be the richest man in the world, but he's not very good at this, and he's kind of a scam artist. Oh, and he's got a son. What?
Yeah, the fatherhood issue stuff.
Come on, man.
You know, and look, I have some issues with The Mandalorian, although I have to say, because we talked about it last week when in the year-end wrap-up show, that I had not watched the last couple when we had said that, and I thought it finished really strong.
It sure did. It sure effing did.
Yeah. So it did. My esteem has been raised since last we spoke. But one thing I think it's undeniable about The Mandalorian is how good Pedro Pascal is in it, right? Like,
yes.
And I feel like he's got so little to work with here. Like,
just brutal.
The daddy issue thing is so, like, so ham-handed. You know what I mean? Like just
here's
so
the thing. The movie tries to make the point that, like, this child has become an afterthought to this man. But you totally ruined that by making the child an afterthought to the movie. Like, you, writer, treated this child the same way his father did.
Yep.
You don't know him. You don't know what he likes or doesn't like or wants to do or believes in.
You don't know
in.
Anything about him.
Exactly.
He's around or he isn't around.
And right.
Other than that, he's like generic kid.
Yes. And to an extent, that's true of every single character in this movie, even down to Wonder Woman. Like, she's more generic than in the first one somehow.
Yeah,
they added nothing to her character. Nothing.
It feels like,
in some ways, you said, you know, they realized they had a talky superhero movie and then tacked on action at the end. I feel like somehow they were not prepared for Wonder Woman to be a hit. And so when it was a hit, the original, they threw together the quickest sequel they could because they knew they had to get it written immediately if they were going to have it out within 2 years, because it takes so damn long to do all the special effects nonsense, that, like, everything but the special effects feels like it was tossed off.
I definitely agree with that part. Obviously, it couldn't have happened that way, right? Like, you don't make a Wonder Woman movie without envisioning franchise possibilities. That's half the reason it exists, right? So,
I don't know, man. Would
it
you
just
put
couldn't
it past,
have played out that way.
Would
but
you
I
put
agree,
it past?
I agree
hold
the
on.
End product.
Would you put it past Hollywood executives to presume before release that the lady superhero was not going to be the biggest movie they ever had?
I get what you're saying, but my counter to that would be that, like, this is part of sort of the Zack Snyder extended world. And I don't think that guy does anything without thinking about two or three more movies that he can make about it. And
right, but
they
I
don't
think,
even have to be good to get there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I think those movies are Justice League and Batman versus Superman, which she appears in, not another Wonder Woman. Like,
by
Justice,
the way, they're already working on a third.
I know. And hopefully they're spending more time on the writing process. Because honestly, it had all the actors it needed. It obviously had all the money it needed. Like, they'd already done a brilliant job casting the superhero, which is not easy. And, like, just the story was so bad.
It was bad. The movie's called Wonder Woman 1984. And yet, I feel like, other than an occasional, like, Frankie Goes to Hollywood song and some of the clothes, like, the period that it's set in is almost completely irrelevant.
That's right. And the clothes aren't even really noticeable except for the one scene where Chris Pine is changing outfits. Also,
right.
Also, the whole
Which
bit,
also felt tacked on.
Yeah. And, like, the whole bit that just, like, he inhabits some random guy's body and then she sees his face the whole movie. Like, everything was just, it just felt so like, oh shit, it's after midnight in the writer's room and the copy's due at 1 a.m. you know?
yes. Like, you know, maybe I give superhero movies a bad rap. But, like, I feel like all the things I dislike about superhero movies are kind of, like, all in this. And honestly, the effects, you could tell, right, they took their time and spent their money there. But I would say, other than the kind of Olympic scene on our home planet, like, most of the action set pieces kind of left me pretty flat, to be honest.
Especially, and this is very annoying, especially the big fight between her and Kristen Wiig. Because it was so damn dark, you could barely see what was going on. Kristen Wiig is suddenly in an absurd Cats, you know, costume from the bad movie Cats that came out a few months ago.
Yeah, right.
Like, I don't understand how. I mean, I know she asked to be an apex predator or whatever, but, like, what are we doing here?
What are we doing here is a great way to sum it up, right?
Yeah.
That would be my line. What are we doing here?
That's why I started this the way I did, talking about how I kind of was braced for a fight until I watched this thing, because it really, this movie validates all of your, like, trite regular criticism of superhero movies because it didn't try in the places that it's important to try to be a movie. You know? Yeah. Like, it just didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I would think by now, I guess, because I should observe reality, but I would have thought by now the big Hollywood decision makers who greenlight this garbage would have noticed that, like, story matters to comic book fans. You know? Like, I think there was a stereotype of comic books 20 years ago of, like, it's just a bunch of nerds looking at pictures. You know, we don't have to do much but put the pictures up on the big screen. But, like, that's not true.
No. So, and I was going to say, well, you know, maybe it's because of the DC side. But, like, they put out Joker. You know what I mean? Which is, like, they have... I feel like they've kind of gotten past, you know, some of the early missteps, right?
You thought.
Of DC.
And I will say, like, this does, because I, just for fun, after I watched Wonder Woman, the original, to sort of remind myself, and by the way, still good, HBO Max started suggesting all the Snyderverse to me, so I've just been sort of putting it on late at night and cruising through them one every couple days or so. And Wonder Woman does, probably just because it's directed by a lady who's a good director, it's not like soaked in the miserable darkness that all the other ones are. Which is just like, if this movie had also been filmed in, like, you know, dark tones and everybody was muttering all the time, it clearly would have been worse. So that's a small mercy this retains, like, the sunshine is at least on it, visually speaking. But it really was just a tired, sad attempt at something that really had a chance to be great.
Yeah. It's disappointing. It's frustrating. And I think everything was so teed up for this movie to have, right, like, kind of it's out at the holidays and everybody's home and it's the thing we're all going to watch, and it could have really been a moment, and it's like they just forgot to write it.
Yeah. It was the holiday movie of the year and they forgot to write it. I think that's the best we can say about it.
Yeah. Okay. Where should we go next?
Either one's fine with me. I mean, it's just a three movie day, right?
We're gonna add a fourth movie, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, it's a four movie day.
But let's talk about Small Axe.
Okay.
So we watched Mangrove was the name of the movie. I guess it's a movie.
It's definitely
this one's really blurry. Steve McQueen says he made five movies and not a TV show with five episodes.
That's right. And when you look at the, like, ads, it says a series of films by Steve McQueen.
Correct. And I have a feeling that, much like the other movie we're going to discuss, that you'll be hearing from, at least a couple of these movies at Oscar time. So we'll continue to call them films. The Mangrove, is about, and I think all of these movies are going to be about, communities of Black people in the 60s. This one is Notting Hill. And
that's right. I think all five movies are specifically about the West Indian immigrant experience in England.
You know, we were sort of talking about this earlier. I like this movie. I like this movie quite a bit. I also found it to be a tough hang. It sort of reminded me of a less extreme version of McQueen's 12 Years a Slave, which is a movie that I thought was excellent.
Yeah.
But I almost walked out of because it's just hard to be in that world.
Sure.
And watch those things. And similarly, it's hard to watch these people be treated this way for 2 hours. You know, knowing that that is absolutely what happened. You know, and that's why we're being shown this. And, you know, the I feel like the way this story ends doesn't necessarily give you a lot of catharsis. The character's got catharsis, but I don't necessarily feel like if the viewer, you know what I mean, that you necessarily ever really are released from that. This sucks. And then you sort of read the after, like the postscript, you know, of like basically like, yeah, well, he went through this exact same thing for the next 20 years. And then enjoyed 3 years of peace before closing the restaurant. You know, it just doesn't like I said, I thought it was really good. The performances are incredible. It's technically a very, like, I think it can be vibrant and good looking, and it's the movie making part of it's excellent, but it was not a lot of fun for me to watch this.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It made me think a lot about what's the point. And I don't mean that dismissively. I mean, very sincerely and seriously, what is this movie trying to say? What is the point of this film? And I think at least part of the point is to make you sit in it. I mean, to make you sort of have to sit in the mistreatment of these people and feel it. And like, outside of that, you know, this is essentially just a historical retelling. And there is some character development, but not a lot. And I think that's very deliberate. Yeah. It's very, I don't want to say news really, because it's so emotional and a lot of the acting is really tremendous, I thought. But it feels like a nonfiction book as opposed to a fiction book, you know?
Yeah, and it's static.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And so I do think there's a ton of sort of film craft involved in that and very impressive. But I do think, like, you know, if that's half of it, the other half is deal with this, because this is what's been happening. And on some level continues to happen.
Right. You know? If there is a point to the movie, I think that's kind of what it is, right? Like, you're understanding that the worldview of the PCs in this movie is kind of on the rise now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where you know, you're looking at this and going, why don't they get it? You know what I mean? And I think that is, I guess, what it's sort of supposed to leave you with. Because really, Mr. Critchlow kind of figures out over the course of the movie that the mangrove means more than food, you know. Darkest, you know, gets better at lawyering.
Right.
And that's pretty much it for growth, I think, over the course of the movie, right? So
yeah, I mean, most of the other characters sort of are who they are, right? And I think that's...
And they're great characters, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not necessarily knocking that, but that's... It's not the most dramatic thing I've ever seen, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I know exactly what you're saying. I don't know if I would say it the same way, but yeah. Yeah, I don't know if dramatic's the right word to say it's not dramatic. Because, again, it's, like, emotional, and the events are dramatic.
Yeah.
But
like, if you like, I thought a lot about the Aaron Sorkin Chicago 9 movie.
Yeah, 7.
You know what I mean? 7? 7, yeah. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. God, don't get old. right, like, it's just the structure of the storytelling of the two trials in this movie just could not be like they were just very interested in very different things.
I think some of that is, England.
Some of it, yes. Yeah.
But you're right. No, even the way they're shot, you feel like you're watching C-SPAN at times in the courtroom. You know, you're just like watching a courtroom. Except, oh wait, that's Letitia Wright. But it feels in a lot of ways that you're just watching a courtroom. But again, like there's no question that's a deliberate effect, right? And so I think that is done in part to just make you sit in the courtroom and watch this mess, you know, and even the shots, like the raids, the way the raids are shot, I feel like it's just like you're a cafe customer, you know? There's not a lot of preamble. It's just, again, all of a sudden the door comes crashing in, and all of a sudden there's cops in your face. And like,
and then just casual racism just flying
exactly.
off. Exactly.
And it's not shot to highlight the action at all. It's shot almost in confusion.
Mm-hmm.
I think all that is done very deliberately, and I think to pretty successful effect, because I spent, you know, and this is, I think, what you're talking about at the start of our chat, is like, we spent 2 hours pretty unhappy, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And at the end, you're a little less unhappy, or at least there's a sense of satisfaction that, you know, this one time, the crooked system did the right thing. But you're also left with the feeling that the only reason the crooked system did the right thing is because actually the evidence was so overwhelming that the 12 people or however many sit in a British jury, like, had to acquit them. Like, the lies were too obvious.
Yep. And less unhappy, I feel like, it's just a good way to put that. you're not overjoyed. You know what I mean? I remember feeling that way about 12 Years a Slave, too, at the end, where it was like, I went through all this, and I thought I was going to feel a lot better when it reached whatever dramatic conclusion it was going to reach. You know what I mean?
There's like, here's what these movies do not do is, like, vindicate humanity at the end.
No, they do not.
And I think that's something that we're used to in narrative films, even if they're about terrible people. You know, if it's like Schindler's List has tons of awful people all throughout it and horrifying atrocities, but in the end, it really vindicates humanity, right? Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what these brutal dramas, what we've become accustomed to them doing over the years, is like at the end, at least some portion of humanity gets vindicated as like people are basically okay. But not here.
Correct. And it's not that I need the movie to do that, to tell me that people are okay, but man, it's just hard. Like,
it's heavy.
Like, you just don't want to come out of something feeling crappy.
You want
to come out
of
entertainment feeling crappy.
You feel like you got to watch some Big Mouth or something afterwards just to like, knock you out of the mood, you know? I totally agree, but I also strongly recommend this film.
Yeah, and I don't feel like I've said enough that Letitia Wright just jumps off the screen, I feel like.
It's tremendous. And the guy who plays Frank Critchlow, I thought, was excellent.
Me too. I don't really know who he is.
No. Did you recognize anybody outside of Letitia Wright? I recognized a couple other British actors from, like, small things. Like, the director from I Hate Susie was one of the people on trial.
The judge was on The Crown.
Yeah. Little things like that. But Letitia Wright is really the only actor.
Who was the white lawyer, the white defense lawyer?
Yeah, I looked him up, and he has, like, small parts in one or two things I've seen, but he hasn't been much.
Yeah, I didn't know who he was, but there was, like, a bit of a...
He looked a little
kind
familiar.
Of looked familiar. Uh-huh. Yeah, vibe about him.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move to Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
Yep.
So I was unaware about much about the movie coming in. And I think it probably took me 5 minutes to go, oh, okay, this is an August Wilson play.
I mean, I didn't have quite that explicit a realization, but it was so quite obviously a play. And when it said at the end it was an August Wilson play, I was like, oh, of course it was. And I thought, much like Fences before it, it was a pretty good and clearly, I shouldn't say faithful, because I have no idea how faithful it is to the play per se, but like, playish. It is not in any way altered to be more of a movie. It is a play on screen in the same way that Fences was. It all takes place in two rooms. It's all very talky and speechy. And that's fine. But I also was, I also did not realize that going in.
Yeah. And the theater of it took me out of it a little bit. You know what I mean? It's almost, you know, this is my second Sorkin reference of the podcast, but you know, like when you're watching Sorkin and the characters have a certain rhythm that is Sorkin, but and great, but also not quite human. I feel like these August Wilson movies that I've seen have a similar quality where it's like, okay, we're in the August Wilson verse, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. On a specific level, a very different quality than Sorkin, but like philosophically speaking, a quality that is neither lifelike nor particularly movie-like.
Right. And you're going to get a lot of monologues and you're going to get, you know, they have a certain rhythm.
And listen, those monologues in this movie are delivered tremendously.
Yes.
I mean, Chadwick Boseman and Viola Davis and Coleman Domingo and Glenn Turman all have awesome speeches that they absolutely murder in this movie in like a beautiful stage acting way.
Yeah.
And most of these people, I don't know about Viola Davis. I don't know what her stage experience is, but certainly Coleman Domingo was a stage actor for 20 years before he broke into TV and movies, really. Chadwick Boseman, I know, had stage experience. So like,
Viola Davis does stage even now. Like, I think she's had a fair amount.
I would assume so based on the performance. But they're very much the performances you'd see in a Broadway playhouse, as opposed to the normal deliveries and performances you would see in a movie.
There's a moment in one of the Chadwick Boseman monologues where he's like talking to God and like yelling up at the ceiling and, you know, sort of like not looking at any of the people in the room with him.
Right.
And I was like, this is so like this is straight theater right now. We're watching,
right.
You know,
like,
I mean?
I can literally picture him stepping to the front of the stage and just yelling it to the audience. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he's really like, it, you know, in the theater, he's looking into the balcony. And here he's sort of looking at the ceiling, you know?
Right.
But for me, that took me out of it a little bit. And I almost wonder, because I think that the play itself is saying some things in terms of, you know, black artistry and trying to integrate that or navigate this white world that really seeks to have a parasitic relationship with it. Like, I feel like that message would have fit really well in a contemporary story. Mm-hmm. And I almost wonder if this would have been more interesting if it was like Janelle Monáe playing a contemporary pop star.
Yep.
And I think it could have been in that world could have been a lot more movie-like than than, you know, People in Two Rooms. And I don't know, like, I feel like that might have been more visually interesting. And I don't, you know, I don't say that to take away, you know, saying like, oh, I want to change out all the actors, because I thought the acting was easily the best part of it.
Clearly the best part of it.
But I do think it would have made it more interesting experience had it been set that way.
Right. Yeah. Clearly the acting was the best part of this. Not to denigrate the writing, which is, you know, a good play.
Right. The writing's the reason all those people showed up to do this.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Like a play, those really are the only two things. Like, the only two things here are the acting and writing. There's nothing else to look at, sort of. Like, the set is unremarkable. And again, normal for like a Broadway level, you know, I don't know if this won any awards, but like, August Wilson's a great writer. This works.
Yeah.
You know, it's not bad at all, and I would recommend it. I think people should watch it, if only.
I'm pretty sure it is, and I think Charles S. Dutton, I think, was the originator of the role that Chadwick Boseman plays.
Interesting.
I'm not mistaken on the stage.
But if for no other reason than to see Chadwick Boseman's tremendous final performance, people should watch this movie. But I think it would have been better either, as you described, you know, actually adapted to a modern world movie instead of a, you know, a movie version of the play, or, and look, I know neither of us really enjoyed Hamilton, so maybe that's not the best analog to make here, but do it on stage and just shoot the stage. Because I think putting it in the context of a movie, but performing it like a stage play, does kind of take you out of it. Because the context is wrong. And for me, if we're just...
There's a whole where am I that happens through this whole thing a little bit.
Yeah. And if instead of that, we are just shooting a stage, and this is staged as a stage play, I think it's easier to contextualize the way it's shot and performed. Or make it an actual movie. And I think this thing, and I felt the same way about Fences, and not to pick on August Wilson, I think it's a more of a...
It's not August Wilson's fault. He's not making these movies.
It's a choice by producers. Maybe it's Denzel Washington's fault,
say, because he's the commonality in these two movies, right?
But I think it would be better either just shooting the stage or turning it into more of a movie. But other than that, I don't really have any complaints about the actual production. I just don't know that doing it in this style is the best representation of the material.
Yeah, I agree. And tremendous final performance from Chadwick Boseman.
He's
got
so
a lot
good.
To do.
And you can
what
see.
What did you think about the end?
Before that, just like with Boseman. He's so good. He's so emotional and raw, and you could just see he's physically not okay. You know, it's somewhat heartbreaking to watch. But again, he's so good. You absolutely should watch it.
And he's got so much to do.
So much to do. Yes.
There's so many different shades that he's playing, which is sort of what made me think about that part about the end, rather. And, obviously, that part is coming from August Wilson, but it's a little out of nowhere.
It's sudden.
Yeah, to me, it feels like.
Yeah, the end is sudden and surprising, and then it's over. Right? I mean, it ends very quickly after the big incident, which I don't know that we even need to spoil. But yeah, I was shocked. And if that's the goal, then it worked. But, you know, again, like, it ends like a play, not a movie.
Right. And
if you're sitting like I can imagine sitting again in a Broadway playhouse and the end happens and the lights go off on stage and you're like taken aback, but then the whole room is applauding and everyone's talking to each other about what just happened and it's a different experience.
Yeah, and you get that car ride home.
Yes.
What are you thinking, right? And you know, so that was a little bit lacking for me where I'm sort of just like, whoa.
Right.
And I didn't quite know what to do with it. I don't know what I think it's trying to say.
Yeah. And again, that just speaks to the differences between what you are accustomed to seeing in theater versus what you're accustomed to seeing on film.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think this movie is going to win a ton of awards, though.
Fences did, right? And again, I'm not sure this doesn't deserve acting awards. Chadwick Boseman's probably going to win an award, right?
Yeah, I think Viola Davis is a pretty good shot too.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. I wouldn't have any pro. I mean, we'll see who's nominated or what have you. But I can't off top think of any performances that would make those two not worthy. They were great, but it is a little weird because it feels like they should be up for a Tony.
Yeah, sure does. Sure does. Do you want to jump into Happy Season real quick?
Yeah. What'd you think?
I think you know, we've talked a lot about sort of bad time entertainment. Like, I think this was, you know, the sort of the opposite of that. You know, but in a lot of ways, outside of the sexual gender politics of it. Pretty standard issue rom-com, right? All the way around, from the way it was shot and looked and all of that. You know what I mean? It was a fine time, but it's a movie I've seen a million times before, except, you know, people were straight.
Right. Pretty classic, three stars out of four rom-com.
Yeah, I'd say that's exactly right.
And Kristen Stewart is really good. Mackenzie Davis is either awful or excellent. And I can't tell because I just hated her character so much. I just, the whole time I was like, you can do better, Kristen Stewart. Get out of this awful town. And I think that was sort of the point. So I think Mackenzie Davis did a good job. But yeah, like the, even, you're right that maybe we haven't seen this particular version of the lesbian romantic comedy that many times, but like the disapproving dad who in the end comes around is like such a rote character. And you know, the like, culture clash between the rich family and the orphan girl is so like, it's all very middle of the road, which I think in a lot of ways is like, it's a good thing. We should have more middle of the road lesbian rom-coms.
I feel like Mary Steenburgen has played that role 12 times.
And look, there's a reason she keeps getting cast in it, because she's very good.
Yeah. No shade to her. But I bet she woke up and was like, I can do this one in my sleep.
that's when Al Pacino reads something where he just has to yell a lot, you know?
Yeah.
Same experience.
Yeah, 100%. You know, it was cool to see Daniel Levy do something else.
Yep.
And I have a feeling there are more of those roles in his future. The rom-com best friend.
Are you kidding me?
If he wants them.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, yeah, I mean, the gay best friend in anything, right? I mean, he's the ideal gay best friend. He's hilarious. He can be both bitchy and, like, emotionally supportive. Like, that's his wheelhouse. I mean, that's everybody, except with the possible exception of the two leads, everyone is just doing their thing here. Everyone is doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing in a movie, right?
Yeah. I feel like Kristen Stewart, I feel like she had some vigor in this. Like, she seemed sort of excited to rip into that part.
Yes.
Which I liked, and I thought she was very good. That she was the bright spot of the movie.
I totally agree. I think she was the one, the acting performance that was like, oh, she's very good, as opposed to just, of course, you know, like,
yeah.
And maybe that's right, because we haven't seen her do this quite as much. Like, we've seen her do like the sad Twilight thing, but like being a fully realized human with feelings is something we haven't seen quite as much of.
Yeah. Yeah, and I liked it on her.
Totally. She should do more things. I like Kristen Stewart.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm now thinking about those random Trump tweets about her from like 3 years ago that would surface up every now and again.
Oh boy.
Anyway, sorry to take us out to the Twitter apartment. I don't know where that came from.
It's almost over.
But you know, he has some ideas about where she should go next.
Yeah.
All right, I think that's that was a pretty interesting week, all in all.
It was. I like a movie week every now and again, you know. Not a lot of TV going on right now. I think it's kind of hiding in the holiday season, but I think we're hitting a bit of a corona lull in television programming.
Yeah, there's usually a lull this time around every year. It's right, the networks are you know,
dark
on hiatus, and that includes, I would say, all of cable, right? HBO is not really rolling stuff out, but streaming usually has a few shows.
Right.
This year they just have movies, it seems like.
That's what it seems like. Yeah.
Although next week, if you want to jump into homework, Netflix is dropping Cobra Kai.
Oh yeah.
Which I think they've done a really good job of sort of setting up from a marketing standpoint. Like, obviously the first two seasons were in the world and existed,
right?
But kind of went to a new level when they appeared on Netflix.
Netflix has timed this rollout really well to give everybody enough time to watch the first two seasons and get fired up for a third.
Yeah. Although I have some thoughts about season two that I'll share next week, I feel like.
Okay. All right.
Because I think there may be a few cracks in all the good feeling that has been Cobra Kai to this point.
By next Tuesday, we will have some new evidence to present. So we'll see.
Yeah, I'll just say I have some concerns about where season three might be headed. We'll see see if those work out or not.
All right.
But still very excited. despite those concerns, for that. And then we're going to watch another one of Small Axe.
Yeah.
What do you think the chances are it's going to be less depressing?
Yeah, I'm afraid there's a pretty good chance it's equally depressing, but the name sounds less depressing, if that's any help. It's called Lover's Rock.
Yeah, you're right. That doesn't sound so depressing, but Mangrove doesn't sound all that depressing either if you just read the title.
No, that's true. That's true. But, like, for instance, the third one is called Red, White, and Blue, and just the fact that that's flag colors makes me feel like it's probably pretty dark.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I will say there was one scene, the street parade in Mangrove. I want to go to that party, man, when they're all dancing. Dude. That looked fun as hell.
The Mangrove looked like an awesome place to hang out, no question.
Yeah, seriously. Play some cards.
And I he kept being like, "We only serve spicy food here," and I was like, "I want it." This racist ass cop is like, give me a bland pudding for God's sakes, and I'm like, no, I want some curry.
Yeah, spicy food clearly won that war over there for
sure.
Yeah,
they did.
it's hard to imagine modern day England without spicy food.
True story. Because at some point the racism declined at least enough that people were like, our food is terrible, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Tasty food is undefeated against racism.
It's so true. That's so true. Yes. There's plenty of people who want to build a wall to keep out the violent Mexicans but love a goddamn burrito.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're letting the burritos are still getting in.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of which, that's probably a good segue to Death to 2020, which is the Charlie Brooker Netflix special that I don't know too much about other than that. Although I feel like Netflix is running trailers now. It may even be out.
One would assume it's going to be out before the end, or at least at the end of 2020. Otherwise, what are we doing?
Exactly. So
yeah, in fact, according to what I'm seeing, it just came out. So it should be available.
Death to 2020. And then Sylvie's Love, which is Tessa Thompson. And I did not realize until you mentioned it today, Namdi Asomugha, former Raider, 49er, Eagle.
Yeah, man.
And Cal Bear.
Yeah, California Bear. And listen, I maybe people don't care. This guy's basically my age, a few months older than me. He played 10 seasons in the NFL, made God knows how much money. I'm trying to look it up right now, but whew, at least 40 or 50 million. And since then has been working his way up the acting ladder, so to speak, making appearances in a TV show here or there, then some smaller movies. Some
stage work. Been doing a lot of stage work.
Some funnier die stuff. A little bit of stage work. He actually was nominated for a couple of awards for a small film he was in called Crown Heights, and it was a Lakeith Stanfield vehicle. And I'm interested to see this. It sounds like he's actually a very good actor. He's been putting his money to good use in the meantime, starting charities and whatnot. He's always been known as a particularly sharp guy for a football player, which, I don't want to put too much into that, but that's nice. I like following his career, and I'm interested to see how he does.
I can't believe you got through that whole resume without mentioning that he's Mr. Kerry Washington.
Oh, yeah. And he's married to Kerry Washington. Kerry Washington is cool, too.
But, yeah, he's living a good life. And it is rare because, Namdi Asomugha was Darrell Revis at one point, right?
He was great.
The shutdown corner, right, in the league.
Right up until the point where he got paid.
Yeah, really. And it's rare to see a player of that quality go to acting and not really just sort of be like, I'm a famous person here to kind of be myself, right? Like O.J. Simpson or Jim Brown or, you know, there's some of that tradition.
Well,
and then there
maybe especially because that's how you can get bigger jobs quicker, right?
Right.
Like,
right.
You don't get like if you either use your fame to get into movies now, or it's like a long, tough road. Not a lot of guys come out of professional sports with $50 million looking for a long, tough road.
Right. There's the other guy that washes out kind of a football or like plays a little bit and doesn't play much and, you know, and then goes into acting and kind of, you know, like sort of the Terry Crews path.
Right.
If you will. You know, there's sort of that way to go about it too. But you don't really see guys like Namdi start at the bottom, essentially. And I think that's pretty cool. There's a, by the way, a pretty good Real Sports profile on him that tackles all this, if you're interested.
So yeah, look, this is not the sort of movie I'd usually be excited about, but
yeah, I'm not interested in the movie at all. It's the trailer, and I didn't like the look of it. But I love Tessa Thompson,
exactly.
And I'm excited about this. So
we both love Tessa Thompson, and I don't know, man. Like, it's a cool life for Namdi Asomugha, and I'm just interested to see how good he is.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll let you know in a week. and yeah, I think that's it. We'll probably talk some NFL playoffs as those fields will be set
on
Tuesday.
That's right.
And neither of our teams will be in. Oh wait, your
Calm
team
down.
Might be in it. Sorry. I wasn't trying to toss your team out of the playoffs.
Well, but also we have to beat the Packers. So let's not kid ourselves, huh?
It's true, but you could lose to the Packers and get some help too, right? Like, I think that's a thing still, isn't it?
Maybe. I guess if Arizona loses again, I don't know. I can't remember exactly how it works, but the odds are not great for the Bears, but they're not zero.
Correct. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see the field set and sort of interesting to lay it out because this year is more wide open, I think, than many in recent memory. So
we, of course, will be back on Thursday with a full challenge breakdown as well.
Yeah. I'm fired up for that. Fired up to just go at another episode of what's been a spectacular season so far.
Quickly before we go, did you happen to listen to Tori and Anissa's podcast this week?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
You know,
so you learned.
Sorry, go ahead.
You learned the most important behind the scenes challenge knowledge that we have yet learned from the podcast, which is that Big T likes to gamble on eliminations.
I did not think that was what you were going to say, but yes, we did learn that. The other thing that I thought was interesting that we learned that had not been revealed anywhere to me is that Devin told Tori he was going to pick her, like, off camera. Like, she was not surprised when he infiltrated her team.
Yeah, although she made it sound like he said it in a way that was like she couldn't tell if he was just messing with her, you know? But, yeah. And just in general, they talked a lot this week about how much there is that doesn't make it to air, which of course you realize, but you don't totally think about when you're watching.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, and hopefully someday we'll have someone from the challenge on and we can get some of these questions answered. But I do wonder, like, obviously they're being filmed much more than you see. You're watching an hour a week, but how much more, right? Like, are there certain hours of the day where they know that nobody is filming them?
Sounds like no, because they talked about the surveillance cameras running 24/7 and having to scan all the footage. So I don't know. It sounds like they're pretty much on camera all the time. But either way, this is a discussion for Thursday. And Derek Kaczynski does now follow me on Twitter, so maybe we can actually reach out to him.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting idea.
He's a Bears fan.
I like that. Yeah, he's a Chicago kid.
I somehow didn't realize that. But then right after I tweeted about it and he tweeted back at me and followed me, I realized, I was watching an episode of The Duel And in the post-credit outtake scene, there's a scene where they're all in the van and they start doing like a acapella band thing. They're all very drunk, right? And, right. You know, like Anissa and Evan and I think maybe CT are being like, ba-ba-dee-ba-doo-da-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. And then Derek just goes, the Bears. The White Sox. And I was like, how did I miss that the first time around? I should have known.
He is, to me, a just in the same class as like a CT or a Durrell.
He's a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Like just, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. A first ballot Challenge Hall of Famer. We'll talk about that later on Thursday. Challenge episode. Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard, the eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor, have yourself a tremendous evening.